Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Hotel from Barigani. What's happening in peace? January 12th through the 13th, Jacksonville, Florida, we will have Summit of the Moors. This is a collective effort to bring about economic security that is a great opportunity for our people to forecast their own future, beginning with a collective approach that can benefit all. The educators, the speakers are all diverse to represent the people who are also diverse in their ideologies. On deck, we have Kadara Bey, Dr. Aileen Bey, Julani Bey, Tahaka Amina L. Bey, Abundance Child, Sundiata L., Daraya Bey, the Federation of Southern Cooperative, German Shannon L., Sharif Noble, and myself, Asar Dalo Saku Abur L. Topics will be food security, such things as aquaponics, gold and silver purchasing, technology, cooperative application, the administrative process, and lots more. We also have what's called private side sessions. These sessions will not be recorded, any recording, audio, or visual for the public. You have to be in person in order to get these jewels. And we also have some special guests who didn't want to be advertised that will come and drop more information. I'm urging everyone to go to www.dalosaku.com and register. This is free. This is a free event. It is www.dalosaku.com. DialoSekou.com. January 12th through the 13th, Jacksonville, Florida, Summit of the Moors. Peace.
Welcome, Moors, to Moors Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay. And this evening, we'll be dealing with the power of contracts and contract law. We'll be answering the following questions. What is a contract? Where does contract law come from? What is a verbal contract? Can someone be held to a verbal contract? How do courts and law firms view contracts? Are contracts meant to be broken? What is a contractor? What is offer and acceptance? Should contracts be reasonable? What is a contract clause? These questions, much, much more, we're going to touch on this evening, ladies and gentlemen. So y'all buckle your seatbelts. Make sure you got your pencil and paper handy and copy this information down. Also, I would like to say, once again, I've been put in a box, so to speak, on Facebook. So those of you who are there, send a friend request to Tahaka Amana L. Bay, and I'll grant it. That give you access to my wall and the articles and stuff that I placed there for your education. You'll be able to access that. That's Tahaka Amana, and then L, and then Bay, E-L, and then B-E-Y. And also, we're going to be dealing with, I know a lot of you all have seen me post information about a little money-making opportunity, and I have a whole lot of fun with it. It works for me. and I want to give you the ins and outs of it here this evening. But before we get started, let's look at our current conditions inside the United States so y'all sit still and hold your hat, and we'll be going on down into this thing, okay?
The effects of the current economic crisis have touched everyone. Even if you still have a good job and a paid-up mortgage, chances are your monthly 401k statement will remind you that you've lost a good chunk of your savings. Trillions of dollars have evaporated from those accounts that have become the prime source of retirement funds for a majority of American workers, affecting their psyche and their future. If you're still young enough, there's time to rebuild and recover. But if you're in your 50s or 60s or beyond, the consequences can be dire. And it's drawing attention to the shortcomings of a retirement system that's jeopardized the financial security of tens of millions of people. It was a gray, chilly morning in Midtown Manhattan, and a line of unemployed, mostly white-collar workers stretched for blocks around the Radisson Hotel. More than 1,000 middle managers, stockbrokers, consultants, secretaries, and receptionists had come here hoping to find a job.
If you are just arriving, please step this way.
It was called a career fair, but there was no merriment here, only a whiff of desperation. Many of these people had been out of work for months and burned through their liquid assets, their future even bleaker than the present. Alan Weir, who turned 60 this month, showed us his latest 401k statement, which he hadn't had the courage to open up.
I'm afraid.
You're going to open it now? You want me to?
Let's do it.
There's good reason for his trepidation. Nearly half of his life savings have vanished in a matter of months.
It went down again.
How much are you down overall?
About $140,000.
Do you think you'll ever get it back?
I'll probably never see it come back. I was looking to retire probably when I hit 62. I can't do it now. I'll probably be working until I'm at least 70.
I'm a Microsoft Office diva.
Until she lost her job, Kathleen Coleman had spent nearly 30 years working as an executive assistant on Wall Street. She doesn't have much to show for it.
Tell me about your 401k.
Does this answer the question?
This is what it was in 2005. 2007, you're down below 2005.
Right. And another one went down almost $40,000.
One was 88,000, and then it went down to, like, 50.
How old are you?
54, and I live alone. I don't have any children. I've been a career girl all my life. And it's been a great career, and I don't deserve this. I'm sorry.
Sorry. Right. Have you had any nibbles?
All the nibbles I've had, I get beat out by top models who can type. And I have experience and dedication and loyalty, and I can make any boss shine. I can. If you're out there, I'll relocate anywhere for you.
What, psychologically, what does this piece of paper do to you?
Oh, it crushes any rest I may get when I'm 65. I'll have to work for the rest of my life.
The saddest part of this story is that it's being repeated all over the country. In eastern Pennsylvania, 59-year-old Iris Hans lost her accounting job and half of her 401k investments. She's now back in the workforce as a part-time cashier in a grocery store.
Your debit card. You have a great day.
In Dearborn, Michigan, Terry and Donna McNally are barely holding on. He lost his sales job in August. The condo they bought 15 years ago is worth less than their mortgage, and 40% of his 401k retirement savings is gone. Donna is the main provider now.
Let me hear you count to 10. Can you count to 10?
1, 2,
running a daycare center out of their home.
7, 8, 9, 10.
Are you here for Joan?
Yes.
Terry considers himself fortunate to have found part-time work greeting the bereaved at a funeral home and making lattes at Starbucks.
There you go.
Where colleagues young enough to be his grandchildren have taken him under their wing.
What's the hardest part? I'm no longer sitting in a computer or driving in a car to a call. You know, suddenly I'm standing for 4 to 6 hours and greeting people or making drinks or trying to learn the process and the food business thing, which is very difficult.
It's tough, but I'm proud of him.
at his age to be doing what he's doing.
The 401k drop was tremendous, is tremendous at this point in time, and that's where the savings was. Mm-hmm. That's our hurt right now.
We can't live our vision of our dream of retirement. That's the worst part. Many people can't.
And what was your dream?
Our dream was to have a log cabin up north, Leland area, and just live a nice, quiet life. And we can't do that.
You think you'll ever be able to retire?
I don't see that day. I can no longer see that day.
What kind of a retirement plan allows millions of people to lose 30 to 50% of their life savings just as they near retirement? David Ray, president of the profit-sharing 401k Council of America and a lobbyist for the 401k industry, says it's one that empowers people to make their own investment decisions.
401k is the absolute best way people can save for retirement. They absolutely are the best retirement vehicle we have.
How can you say it's the best available if it has let down tens of millions of people at the time they need the money the most?
That's not a 401k problem. That is our entire investment system. This is about the markets went down for everybody. Nobody was saved in the current thunderstorm.
Ray says that many people still have more money in their 401ks than they've actually contributed. He says everyone had multiple investment options, including low-yield guaranteed returns. And he believes people who lost money have no one to blame but themselves.
In America, it's a society based on freedom and choice and personal responsibility. We need to help them understand these responsibilities and execute them to the best they can. 401k is part of that. There are no guarantees.
What about the people who are 63 or 64? A lot of those people were thinking about retiring.
Well,
and now they aren't.
Well, I mean, there
are a lot of them were retired and have to go back into the workforce.
Well, but that was not a 401k problem. That's an investment system problem. The markets go up and down, and if those people chose to take equity risk, there was a logical outcome.
But in fact, the 401k plans that have become the primary source of retirement income for 60 million Americans were never designed to be retirement plans in the first place. They were created in the late 1970s as a savings plan and tax shelter for ordinary Americans.
The idea was that workers would make voluntary contributions and employers would match a portion of them. The taxes would be deferred until the employee reached the age of 59 and a half. It was supposed to supplement the two traditional income streams for retirees, Social Security and pensions, one leg of a three-legged stool that would support American workers into their golden years. But it didn't turn out that way.
The three-legged stool, if you will, has gone to two legs and it's wobbly, and it's wobbling, and I'm not sure that it's going to support anything. And that's the scary part, and people are afraid.
Brooks Hamilton has helped design retirement plans for some of the country's largest corporations. He says 401ks turned out to be so much cheaper than funding pensions that many companies decided to freeze their pension plans and replace them with 401ks. The decision created millions of new employee investors for Wall Street and the financial community, and they pounced on the opportunity.
If you go back and track the mutual fund growth in assets, and you track the growth in 401k plans, it looks like a railroad track leading to the sky. They are parallel tracks.
So the big beneficiaries were the mutual funds.
That's right. That's correct.
When employers began turning 401ks into retirement plans, the financial community was not shy about promoting them as such. The prospect of trillions of dollars in the hands of unsophisticated investors opened the door for all sorts of potential abuses.
The fact is that the typical 401k investor is a financial novice. They don't know a stock from a line. And we give them a list of 20 or 30 mutual funds with really, really powerful names. You know, they sound like, gee, that's where I want to have my money.
What are generally the quality of the mutual funds and 401k plans?
Mediocre. I'll be real honest with you. With half the funds on the list, really dogs, what people would characterize as dogs, shouldn't be on the list to start with.
There clearly has been a raid on these funds by the people of Wall Street, and it's cost the savers and the future retirees a lot of money that would otherwise be in their account, independent of the financial collapse.
Representative George Miller of California is chairman of the House Committee on Education and Labor and a staunch critic of the 401k industry. especially its practice of deducting more than a dozen undisclosed fees from its clients' 401k accounts.
Now you got a bunch of economic wizards jumping in and taking money out of your retirement plan, and they don't want to tell you how much. You can't decipher it in simple English, and they're not interested in disclosing it or having any transparency about it.
And most of the people that look at their 401ks have no idea that these fees are being taken out.
No. Where would you find it? Where would you find these fees in this prospectus? You can look on any page you want, and when you're all done reading, and you will find some of the fees and the commissions here, but you won't find them all, and I bet you won't find half of them.
There are legal fees, trustee fees, transactional fees, stewardship fees, bookkeeping fees, finder's fees, and the list goes on and on. Miller's committee has heard testimony that they can eat up half the income in some 401k plans over a 30-year span, but he has not been able to stop it.
We tried to just put in some disclosure and transparency in these fees, and we felt the full fury of that financial lobbying.
David Ray, a lobbyist for the 401k industry, says he favors disclosing the fees, but his partners in the financial industry don't.
You think most people know these fees exist?
I think they know that there are fees. They don't know exactly how large they are.
Why do you think the financial services industry is opposed to fee transparency?
I don't know that they're opposed to it. I think the issue is...
You don't think they're opposed to it?
Well, they want to keep...
You're a lobbyist in Washington, right? You know they're opposed to it. George Miller hasn't been able to get a bill to the floor.
I think they want to keep the systems as simple and not make changes. They like the way things are, and whenever you push people out of their comfort zones, you know, it's an issue.
I mean, they're comfortable with the situation because they're making a ton of money, or they have made a ton of money.
Well, and their systems are set up in certain ways. You know, this is going to be a big change.
We wanted to ask David Ray, who's been so bullish on 401k plans, one last question about what the future holds for people like Terry and Donna McNally and Kathleen Coleman, who you met at the beginning of this story.
Dedicated, loyal, I can be there. There's nothing standing in my way. Thank you. Need a babysitter?
Most of the people that we've talked to are 50 mm-hmm. and 60 years old
right.
and have sustained these losses say
right.
there is no way they're ever going to make them back.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
I think we have to be truth tellers. I think that when a person has hit this point and we've had this unfortunate situation, I don't think we can misrepresent what the possibilities are.
And the reality is that money is not coming back that they've lost.
They can't count on it. They have to, maybe if they work 10 more years, it'll come back by the 10, but it's important that they not have unrealistic expectations.
For more information on your 401k, go to 60minutes.com.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. Now, in discussing contract law, what we have to understand is each and every one of these people that were victimized by the, that became victim of the 401 situation, all were given an opportunity and were faced with the contract. And in a lot of cases, it was offered by their company that they worked for. And of course, we have confidence in the company. We feel like, well, if the company is giving it to us, and you know, and everybody in the on the job is doing it, and I'll go ahead and sign up for mine, and I'll examine the information that they give me briefly, but I'm not going to go to the extent of turning over all the rocks and pulling out all the stops and clearly understanding all the terminology of the contract. Now, anytime that you're going to enter into a contract, be it verbally or be it written, you have to, it behooves you to clearly understand what it is before you put your signature on the dotted line. Because just like these people here, they worked all their lives and they really thought they were set. They figure, well, okay, this is foolproof. This is safe. But now, if you had come to one of these people and had asked them, to give you every conceivable reason why they know beyond any shadow of a doubt that their 401k is sound, they would have given you a few words off the top of the head. But I doubt if any of them could have gave you a consistent definition for the entire terminology of the contract and fully understood it, because if they would have, I think they would have done something a little bit differently. When it comes to contracts, a contract is, according to the law, they're meant to be broken. We're going to cover that information. They're designed to be broken. But a contract is what we call an agreement between two people, and because we agree and we accept and we agree, that is the only thing that makes it binding. We can enforce contracts with our signature on the dotted line in a lot of cases, but there are cases where these contracts cannot be recovered and where you cannot recover from these contracts. So what we're going to do here this evening is we want to get all the ins and outs and nuts and bolts and wiggle pins of exactly what a contract is. We want to look at this thing from every conceivable angle. I doubt if we'll be able to cover this thing in this entire broadcast, but I'm going to do the best I can. If we can't get it all here today, we'll come back with part two. So y'all hold your hat. Let's get down in here.
You can't stop a woman.
All right. Here we go.
I'm Christian Molesky, Executive Officer of the HBA of Berks County, Pennsylvania. And I'm not an attorney. I am an MBA. We're going to translate the lofty ivory tower language of the attorney into thingamajig, how you doing, and whatchamacallit, so that the average Joe and Jane contractor can apply it to their business today. Although this is based on Pennsylvania law, it will apply in most other states as well. I did put a little bit of legalese in here, but the goal of today's contract section is to explain it in plain English. So I'm not going to read what's on the papers, but I did provide some of the information on the papers so that you can understand what the way the lawyers look at things. And I do want to start out with the definition of a contract. So we're going to start out way at the beginning, but we're going to move pretty quick and get past that pretty quick. So the definition of a contract is a voluntary, deliberate, keyword, deliberate, and legally binding agreement between two or more competent parties. Now, normally we see it between two in the contractor world. It's either us as the contractor and the, whether it be the homeowner or the business owner, or maybe another contractor that would be our trade contractor underneath us. If we're selling material, then it might be us as the material or vendor supplier and the company that's receiving the material. We may have an annual contract or a one-time contract. Between two or more competent parties, contracts are usually written, but may be spoken or implied, and generally have to do with employment, sale, lease, or tenancy. Obviously, also construction and contracting, which isn't listed. Kind of ironic that the lawyers did not list. We're called contractors, after all, but yet they forgot us in their legal definition. I find that ironic. So a couple of reasons I point that out is a contract has to be deliberate. It has to be purposeful. So there has to be an agreement between two parties that there's going to have an exchange. And that's where the next term comes in. The next term is called consideration. And consideration is we both have to get something out of it. We both have to have value. The homeowner gets their roof repaired, their pipes fixed, a new furnace installed, new landscaping or a new kitchen countertop, whatever the case may be, we get money. Or the supplier gets money and we get parts and pieces to help us do the job. Or the subcontractor gets money and we get the benefit of their skills and labor to help us complete the job that we're working on, and we're treating them as a...
Okay. Now, that was just a brief gist of what a contract is, but now let's go a little bit deeper. And the reason I want to do this is because every day we enter into contracts. Okay, your son comes to his father and say, "Well, Dad, could you take me to the baseball game Saturday?" And dad says, sure. Yeah, son, we can go to the game. Matter of fact, I'll get the tickets. Okay, and his son asked him, which was an offer. He accepted the offer. But then when Friday come, young man he's all set because he knows dad is going to take him to the game tomorrow because dad said he would because he just entered into a verbal contract. But when Saturday comes, something comes up and dad has to it's almost time to go to the game. The little boy said, "Well, dad, we supposed to go to the game. You still going to the game?" "Oh man, I forgot. Man, I'm sorry, man. Tell you what, let's catch the next game." "Okay, well now what we have is a defaulted contract. Even though it was a verbal contract, dad is defaulted on the contract. So if we understand the importance of contracts, then we can best fulfill them and make sure that they are not defaulted upon." Okay?
Welcome to the University of Michigan Dentistry Podcast Series, promoting oral health care worldwide.
It has been said that it is much easier to solve problems during the formation of a contract than after a breach occurs. Contract law is indeed a very complex subject. However, the dentist should be familiar with at least the basic principles before entering into binding agreements, which can have far-reaching ramifications both professionally and in one's personal affairs. Here to discuss the fundamentals of contract law is Daryl Negendank, an attorney and assistant professor of legal studies in the College of Business at Eastern Michigan University. Daryl, where does contract law fit into the entire structure of laws that exist today?
Well, first you have to differentiate between criminal law and civil law. Criminal law is where they have passed statutes, legislative action, that have defined criminal acts. And then when someone violates one of these criminal acts, they are prosecuted by the people of the state of X versus the defendant. The result of that trial will be a decision of guilt or not guilty, and then the person is either incarcerated or they pay a stiff monetary fine. In civil law, you have private individual suing another private individual for any of a number of complaints, and the result of that trial will be liability or non-liability. You can have a jury trial or you can have a non-jury trial in the case of civil liability or civil cases. And then the penalty involved is usually monetary damages, although there's an area of the law called equity where you can have a court order, an injunction that people have heard about.
But people don't go to jail for not honoring
the
contract.
No, there's never a problem with incarceration for violation of contract law or tort law. Which brings up, there's a distinction in civil law then breaks down to tort law and contracts. Torts are your whole gambit of malpractice, negligence. Your product's liability often falls into the tort area where someone is injured as a result of the products on the market. Then there's contract law, and that is a subset of the law with its own set of rules and guidelines, and the type of result of the case depends a lot on this contract law that has developed over centuries and time.
In your experience as an attorney, what kinds of contracts have you seen that dentists generally get involved in the operation of a dental practice?
Well, that can be the whole range of contracts. First of all, you have a contract with your patient for care, and then of course you have to, in order to run the dental office, you have to have contracts with suppliers, contracts on a regular basis.
Welcome to the University of Michigan Dentistry Podcast Series, promoting oral health care worldwide.
In part one of this two-part series, we discussed the elements of a contract in some detail. Today, we're going to look at the contract in terms of its function and the various aspects of establishing a dental office and in the daily operation of the practice. Our guest is Daryl Negendank, an attorney and assistant professor of legal studies in the College of Business at Eastern Michigan University. Daryl, in our last program, we touched very briefly on the contract in terms of what contracts must be in writing. Could you amplify that just a little bit for us?
Well, you have to talk about various types of contracts. Let's first talk about patient care. What you're referring to is a very old statute we inherited from England called the Statute of Frauds. It really has nothing to do with fraud. Probably today you'd call it the Statute of Writings. It requires, in order for the court to look at a contract, whether it's enforceable or not, that there be some writing between the parties and signed by the party against whom enforcement is sought, the person you're going to sue. So if the patient wants to sue the dentist, then the dentist's signature would have to appear thereon. If the dentist wants to sue the patient, you have to have the patient's signature thereon. And the writing doesn't have to be a formal contract. It can be a series of memorandums, a series of correspondence between the parties.
What if there is no correspondence in absence of that? It's a verbal contract and
then
it cannot be heard?
Well, it depends. In the area of patient care, there are two rules. There are several rules under the Statute of Frauds. Two main rules. First one, if the contract is impossible to perform within 1 year, it has to be in writing. Because of the nature of dental services, most contracts wouldn't have to be in writing for the courts to enforce, because the question is not probable or what the parties contemplated, but sheer impossibility. So if you make out a long-term treatment plan and you and the patient decide that it'll take 18 months or 2 years to complete, the court will not look at what you decided upon. They'll look to see whether it was physically possible to complete. That is, if the patient came in every day and sat in your chair 8 hours a day, could you have completed the work in less than 1 year? Now, the area of orthodontics, you've got a problem there because of the long-term nature that it isn't possible to perform within 1 year. The court says it has to be in writing if impossible to perform within 1 year. Now, another aspect of patient care in regard...
Okay. Now, what I'm trying to do here is give you some of the ins and outs contracts, because they exist everywhere. Most of us will go to a dentist to get a tooth pulled. The only thing that we're concerned about is getting that tooth out. But we have to understand that we are still in a contract situation involving contract law. It doesn't matter what it is. Even if you're in the grocery store making a purchase, you're entering and exiting contracts. And when we become conscious of the fact, even if we're on the road and the police approaches us, he cuts on his life behind us, we're about to be involved in a contract situation. If we're going into the courtroom, we're about to be involved in a contract situation. If you're talking to an insurance company, if you're talking to a banker, it's always, inside the United States, it's always about contracts. So if we can understand it from that point of view, if we can just keep it right at the forefront of our minds and understand that when we get ready to do different things that we normally have been doing all the time and we're always ending up on the bad end of circumstances, we fail to realize that, okay, we're finna deal with a contract situation. So how, what can I do to make sure that I'm coming out in the winning position of a contract? Now, let's look at something else, and then we're going to come right back to the details of the contract.
Hello, everybody, again. Thanks for being here. Today I want to talk a little bit more about the presumption, but I want to tie in the exhaustion administrative remedies. This is the doctrine. It's called the Doctrine of Exhaustion of Administrative Remedies, and it's in the Black's Law Dictionary under Exhaustion of Administrative Remedies. And it starts out and says that the doctrine requires that where an administrative remedy is provided by statute, relief must first be sought by exhausting such remedies before the courts will act. Okay, so what we're finding here is this is the doctrine, and this is the law, the rule, that you go to your adversary before you go to court. So you have to settle this with the adversary. And when you're stopped or approached by an agent, then you're in court right there, and you have to exhaust the remedy of finding out exactly what the charges really are. And the reason why I say that is because we just learned about the presumption, the rule of presumption, so we don't know exactly what the charges are because the agencies are acting under what's called a presumption. So once the officer stops us and he's operating under the presumption that we're driving, well, we have to raise this issue before it gets to the court. Otherwise, they're going to go by this fact, presumptive fact, as if it's the truth now because we didn't object. And where we object is at the administrative remedy before we get to the court. Now, under this doctrine, a petition for a habeas corpus by a state... The doctrine requires the party to use all available agency administrative procedures before resorting to the court for relief, and requires that a party not only initially raise the issue in the administrative forum, but requires the party to proceed through the entire proceeding to a final decision on the merits of the entire controversy. See, so this means that when you start to exhaust this remedy, you have to take it all the way. Because what will happen is you might raise it at the hearing or at the initial confrontation with an agent, but then if you don't conclude it at the very end, he may flip right back over to his remedy, which is his presumption. So we have to get it all the way through and make him produce the evidence that forms or is the bolster or the basis of his complaint. Okay, and that evidence is going to be that you were driving. The evidence that he has to violate your security and show your papers. See, because we have to remember when you first get pulled over and these agents approach us, if they want to talk to us, they're going to have a cause to act. And that cause is either civil or criminal. If it's civil, then it's like a citizen's arrest. If it's criminal, then he's going to need a warrant. And that'll be the basis of his presumption. Now, if he doesn't have a warrant, then the basis of his presumption is that he doesn't need a warrant because you're doing an activity that he can regulate. And that would be driving. Okay, so if you're presumed to be driving, he's presumed to have authority. But what if you rebut that presumption? Okay, the form of rebutting it would be in the nature of exhausting your administrative remedy. Oh, well, wait a minute, you are presuming that I'm driving, you're presuming you don't need a warrant, but I'm going to have to rebut those presumptions, and I'm going to require you to produce the evidence now. Because you're operating under presumption, not under fact. See, and if you don't meet that presumption right there, then they're going to presume it's a fact because you didn't raise the issue. And if you proceed to the next step, then it becomes a fact that you were driving. And he doesn't have to prove it. So this is the presumption, the doctrine of exhaustion of administrative remedies is the opportunity to rebut the presumption. This is where the presumption is rebutted. Because if you don't rebut it by then, by the end of that administrative hearing, then you agree. And it's become a final conclusion. And this is what we have to understand. And that's why when you finally get to the court, you're already guilty. And that is shown to you by them saying, well, we're presuming you're innocent. When they presume you're innocent, that means you're guilty. So that's how they're operating, by the presumption under the exhaustion remedy. Now, if you meet that presumption, the burden of producing the evidence shifts over to them, the other side, and now they have to produce it. Okay, so we need to understand the burden of proof and the burden of producing evidence and the rules of evidence, and this is how these trials operate. Basically, by these rules of evidence and the rules of court, the rules of procedure, And we need to understand that so that we can then take the proper action. So we need to learn how to rebut these presumptions, when to rebut the presumptions, where to rebut these presumptions. And that's the next phase, is this action. What actions can we take? And by actions, I mean by speaking up, by filing paperwork that's going to cause the court to shift, or to even cause the court to make a determination if that court has authority to hear the case yet. Because when you go to agree with your adversary in an administrative hearing, that should stop the case from going to the next step. Because these courts don't have authority to hear a criminal case unless there's an actual crime. And they're not set up to hear a civil case unless it's brought by another individual. So we begin to see that an administrative hearing and action, there's really no cause of action, because they're operating under presumption that they don't need a warrant. And so when we go into these courts, we're giving them authority to proceed because we don't object, and once we don't object in their court, they can do whatever they want. There is no law that they're required to follow, because the law that they're following is the presumption law. And operating under the doctrine of exhaustion of administrative remedies, you had your opportunity to rebut the presumption, you failed to do so, now you agree, so why are you arguing here in the court? Okay, so this is where why people are losing right and left, because they're going into the court. Our paperwork and our goal is, what we want to do is to get to the court and tell the court that we're not ready to proceed, that they don't have the authority to proceed, and that they're not set up properly. And the way we're going to do that is by bringing in these agents and having them testify to these facts that they're not proceeding properly because we rebutted the presumption and they failed to meet that presumption. Okay, and so these are the words and understandings and angles that we have to grasp so that we can take the next step of taking the action, putting in the paperwork, meeting the presumption, and stopping the case cold right there and having them dismiss us on the grounds that they don't have authority to proceed because there's no cause of action stated in the plaintiff. Okay, and so next time we'll start working on the paperwork and the different items and motions or papers, the things that we need to put in so that we can actually take action and do something, because that's what's required in order to maintain our liberties and our freedom. So thanks for being here, and I'll talk to you next time.
Okay, let's take a look at this thing from start to finish in the face of contract law. A police officer comes up behind you and cuts his lights on. Now, based on what we've already learned tonight, we know that we're about to enter into a contract situation. So you pull over. He comes up to the car. He says, excuse me, sir, ma'am, do you know why I stopped you? Well, in my case, the first thing I'm going to say is, well, I have to assume that you are stopping me because we are in an attempt to enter into a contract, but I'd like to initiate the contract by giving you my identification, which clearly shows I'm exercising my freedom and right to travel, unless on your contract side you can provide me with evidence of the name and address of a company that's paying me to drive, sir. Okay, now what has happened is I have initiated the contract before it ever got started, took control of the contract, provided ID. He didn't get a chance to ask me for a signed contract that would have put everything in his favor, which is called a driver's license, which means that he's asking me for property that belongs to the state. If you turn a driver's license on the back, it clearly tells you it's property of the state. So I can't give him something that belongs to somebody else. The United States Supreme Court, according to law, has ruled over and over and over again that I already have the freedom of right to travel, and speeding is not a ticketable or arrestable offense. There's no injured party. So I put myself in a pretty good position. Now, he may say, well, I need to see your driver's license. I'm going to say, sir, I don't have one. Am I being detained, or am I free to go? Okay, so the ball is continued to be shifted in his court. So he takes my identification, he goes back to the back, and he types the information in, and he may come and say, well, I see you got unpaid tickets here. I said, well, is there a warrant issued for my arrest? Well, no, but you haven't paid these tickets, and you don't have a driver's license. And I have to say, well, sir, I've already asked you for the name of the company and address of the company that's providing me with revenue to drive. According to the United States Supreme Court, I'm not driving the type of vehicle that it's described as a vehicle in commerce. This is not a 8-seater. It doesn't weigh all these tons like it's outlined in the law and all these things which constitute a person that's driving and being paid to drive. So now he may decide, well, I don't know anything about it, and I'm going to write a ticket. Now, you remember in our last broadcast, I already told you, when you are dealing with these situations, always make sure that you got your recording devices inside the automobile. You got your little dash cams there in the back and the front. You got your little audio and video cams, little miniature things mounted into the walls of the automobile. You might even have one hanging on the mirror. Might have one hanging around your neck so you can capture the entire contract situation as evidence. Because if this guy writes you a ticket now, he's trying to force you into a contract, okay? And also, you want to make sure that you let him know in the beginning that you are acting as the primary shareholder of the estate, so which means that there's no room for him at the top. You're already occupying the position. You've already put that information on the record. So now you go ahead and put this down on the disc, and now it's time for us to go ahead and finish with the paperwork on the contract. Now, this guy writes you a ticket. He's got his name at the bottom of the ticket. We cannot sign this contract because we're opposing the contract. We've already initiated a proper contract, which he refused to acknowledge. So therefore, even though it was verbal, we're going to make it all tangible. So what we're going to do now is we're going to go home with the ticket, and we're going to make copies of the ticket. We're going to make copies of our World Citizen Passport and attach that by paperclip. Then we're going to draw up the affidavit outlining all of the Supreme Court rulings giving you freedom of rights to travel. We're asking this officer to rebut each one of these Supreme Court rulings. Now, we are seeking damages in the amount of $4,000 per point in this 21 or 31 affidavit. We're going to get this thing notarized and stamped and signed. We're going to put it in a nice big yellow envelope. We're going to take it to the post office, and we're going to send this to this guy, certified mail with return receipt. Now, we're going to take the green receipt, make duplicate copies of the entire situation, and attach the certified mail receipts to the second copy. And when the green receipt returns with the signature clearly showing that they have already accepted the contract, you take that and you attach it there, and you've given this guy approximately 20 days to respond to the contract. Now, he's got to rebut all of these points, prove all of the Supreme Court rulings false. He's got to do that to every last one of them. Otherwise, that affidavit stands as the truth. And if he doesn't do that, he doesn't respond at all, that means that affidavit stands as true. So now, what we'll do now, after we have taken care of that initial stage and he hasn't responded, he hasn't rebutted that affidavit, then we'll come back within what is known as a notice of default with opportunity to cure. and we'll go and fill it out and make a reminder of the affidavit that he's already defaulted upon. We're going to give him an additional 10 days to respond to the affidavit. We're going to get this go ahead and get this notarized and done up, put it in an envelope. Once again, send it certified mail with return receipt. Make our duplicate copy, put all the receipts and attachment to it, put it in the folder on top of the first affidavit. He got 10 days. He doesn't do it in 10 days. Now we come back with the notice of default and dishonor. And we're still asking for $4,000 per point. We're reminding him of the two past affidavits that we have attempted to settle this matter informally with now. And if he doesn't respond on those 10 days, then the last stage where we finally exhaust this process is he'll have to be served with the habeas corpus. And that's the actual lawsuit. That's when one of his fellow officers come to him and say, I'm sorry, Bob, but I got to give you this. This guy's suing you. You're going to have to go to court. And so what we'll do is once we get the court date, then we'll go down there and we'll take all of our affidavits and all of the proof of our side of the contract that was never refuted, never rebutted, never responded to, file it into the court record. We're seeking damages. And, of course, if this guy doesn't show up, then we're asking the judge to issue a capias for his arrest. We're also asking the sheriff if he could relieve him of his duties. Now, let's go on to some more understanding of this contract. But this time we're going to do this from a different perspective. We're going to do this from a money-making perspective. Now, I see I have someone with the hand raised, but before we go, let me open up the lines and area code 201. Area code 201.
It's a piece of that code.
Okay. All right. Okay. Anyway, let's go in now. Look at this thing from a money position. Now, I had told you all earlier that I had gotten involved with a little opportunity to help people make money. A lot of us, we like to get on the computer and we blog and we post little articles and stuff. And a lot of us do this all day long. And so I found a way, because I do a lot of posting stuff and information and educational materials. And I figured out a way to do this and get paid at the same time. So I want to bring this information to the forefront, a little bit of it, and expose you to it. Okay? Y'all sit down.
Hey guys, how's it going? My name is Celester Diaz, and welcome to my video. This video, we're going to talk about the Empowered Network. We're going to discuss whether or not it's a scam, pyramid scheme, whatever you want to call it. But we're going to talk about the Empowered Network, and we're going to review exactly what you're getting with the Empowered Network. Is it a scam or not? So let's begin with that. And then you can make a decision on whether or not this company is a scam. And remember, this is a presentation based on my opinion. So some other people may have different opinions than me. So that's fine with me as well. So what exactly is the Empowered Network? Well, the Empowered Network is a blogging and training platform where you basically receive internet marketing training in a personal blog. Now, the blogging platform is $25 per month. You also have the ability to resell the blogging platform by becoming an affiliate, which is optional. You can choose not to become an affiliate of the company. Now, if you become an affiliate, you earn 100% commissions from each of the sales that you refer. Now, it also has three other products. The products are $100, $500, and $997. There's a total of four products in the Empowered Network. Now, two of those products are recurring billing, the $25 per month program and the $100 per month. Now, the other two are one-time fees. That means that you only pay one time and that's it, and you keep the product. There's a lot of discussion online whether or not the Empowered Network is a legitimate opportunity. Does it have legitimate products? Do they actually sell something? And I want to cover some of that. And First of all, let's begin with the basic membership of the Empower Network. For the $25 monthly membership fee, you get a blog on the empowerednetwork.com domain name. Now, here's one of the most asked questions that I get a lot from people. Why would you pay $25 monthly for a blog where you can get your own personal blog for a lot less? And usually, I have multiple blogs, personal blogs, and usually cost between $7 to $10 per month to have your own blog. That's including, you know, your hosting, purchasing a new domain name, getting a design template, all that type of stuff. And the answer is simple. You get instant authority and a marketing system. That's something that you don't get when you set up a new WordPress blog. Now, this means that you get instant credibility in the search engines. You get built-in capture pages.
Okay. Now, that little bit of information was enough for me to hear, because I spent time clearly understanding marketing and how information works on the internet. And when I began to examine the backside of this operation, I realized that these guys had put hundreds of thousands of dollars in a system that can place you almost immediately in the top marketing sector for pennies. And the only thing that you have to do is blog. They're doing the opening, they're doing the closing, everything for you right there. So I tried it out, and as a result, I have money hitting my account. So I said, okay, well, let me go ahead and expose this to other people. And for a detailed explanation of that, I'm going to put this this full video plug on my website, so you can on Facebook, so you can see the entire thing. Because this guy gives a complete and total breakdown. I'm only able to upload a little bit here, and but I want you to see the full effect of this thing. But all I got to say is it works for me. I'm having a good time with this thing. Well, let's go ahead on. I just explained to you earlier in the scenario about the policeman involving contract law. So let's get into another phase of contracting and clearly get some more understanding of how these things work, okay? So y'all just hold your hat for a moment. It's very important.
I'm Christian Molesky, Executive Officer of the HBA of Berks County, Pennsylvania. And I'm not an attorney. I am an MBA. We're going to translate the lofty ivory tower language of the attorney into thingamajig, how you doing, and whatchamacallit, so that the average Joe and Jane contractor can apply it to their business today. Although this is based on Pennsylvania law, it will apply in most other states as well. Every time when we're thinking about legal issues and contracts, the question you have to ask yourself, and I know some of us want to stay clear, I am not the sue type. I don't like to get lawyers involved. Can't we just do it on a handshake? Can't we look eyeball to eyeball, belly to belly, grip and grin? Let's do it like men. Let's do it like ladies. Let's do this the old-fashioned way. Well, you might think that, but the rest of the world doesn't. And so if that's the way you are, I believe that. I strongly adhere to that myself. And then, oh, by the way, let's just put what we all agreed on paper over here to make the lawyers happy. We have to. Not because I don't trust you, but because I don't trust whoever else. The building that we sit in right now is part of a complex of 16 units. And this particular complex of 16 units, 2.3 acres, has had four landlords in the last 6 years. So we literally have inherited the contracts of every one of our tenants. Literally has a different lease that was either made by, you know, different terms. I mean, everything we're going to talk about today, they're just all over the place. I had to make a very crazy flow chart to help me, or really an Excel spreadsheet, so that I could understand this person has this, this, and this, and this one has that, that, and that, and there's no two tenants that are exactly the same. Now, obviously, we're rectifying that. In fact, one of the documents that I'm going to pass around today is our commercial lease for our tenants here. First of all, when you provide your contract, you're going to do a standard form contract. Here is the Home Builders Association standard form.
Islam, Hotel, Barigani. What's happening in peace? January 12th through the 13th, Jacksonville, Florida, we will have Summit of the Moors. This is a collective effort to bring about economic security that is a great opportunity for our people to forecast their own future, beginning with a collective approach that can benefit all. The educators, the speakers are all diverse to represent the people who are also diverse in their ideologies. On deck we have Kadara Bey, Dr. Aileen Bey, Julani Bey, Tahaka Amina L. Bey, Abundance Child, Sundiata L., Daraya Bey, the Federation of Southern Cooperative, German Shannon L., Sharif Noble, and myself, Asar Dalo Sekou Abur L. Topics will be food security, such things as aquaponics, gold and silver purchasing, technology, cooperative application, the administrative process, and lots more. We also have what's called private side sessions. These sessions will not be recorded, any recording, audio, or visual for the public. You have to be in person in order to get these jewels. And we also have some special guests who didn't want to be advertised that will come and drop more information. I'm urging everyone to go to www.dalosekou.com and register. This is free. This is a free event. It is www.dalosekou.com. DialoSekou.com. January 12th through the 13th, Jacksonville, Florida, Summit of the Moors. Peace.
I'm Christian Molesky, Executive Officer of the HBA of Berks County, Pennsylvania. And I'm not an attorney. I am an MBA. We're going to translate the lofty ivory tower language of the attorney into thingamajig, how you doing, and whatchamacallit, so that the average Joe and Jane contractor can apply it to their business today. Although this is based on Pennsylvania law, it will apply in most other states as well. So I started saying that a little bit earlier. We always need to think in terms of what happens in court. And I know you don't like to think that, and the reason you don't like to think that is the next bullet point. Many of you say, well, my word is my bond. And so the real question is, in current 2012 contractual terms, in legal parlance, what is held higher in the courtroom? Your word is your bond, look a person in the eye, shake their hand, or a contract is meant to be broken. Any thoughts on that? What do you think is actually, a contract is just documenting everybody needs to fulfill the duties of the terms of the contract, or a contract is meant to be broken? What way do the lawyers look at it?
It's meant to be broken.
That's exactly right. The evolution of contractual law, or maybe from most of our point of view, the de-evolution of contractual law in America, is that contracts are meant to be broken. Your word is not your bond. Contracts will and shall and can, maybe not shall, but will and can be broken at any time. However, the contract should specify exactly what the default provisions are. Default is the term that lawyers use to say you didn't hold up your end of the bargain. You didn't pay when you were supposed to pay, but I did the work. Or I delivered the material and you didn't pay. Or whatever the case may be. I didn't pay, you did the work. So that's a default or an event of default. Contracts are seen as meant to be broken. And so the contract needs, and we'll talk about that as we get into specific clauses, contracts are designed or should be designed so that they have provisions in there that say, what happens if you don't do what you agreed upon? Now, that's key. And if you gloss over that, if you forget about that because we're both gentlemen here, we're both ladies, we're both professionals, whatever the case may be, we're both members of the same association, and you don't then put those default provisions, then when there is a default, you're relying on the judge to just make something up. And let's face it, judges are gods in the legal system. Whatever they say goes. They can make you hop on one foot, literally. I mean, and some judges have done some of these crazy things.
So
Okay. Now, that's something else that we have to understand about contracts. Contracts, I said it earlier in the broadcast, contracts are meant to be broken. However, what I try to teach people to do is when you're formulating a contract with the knowledge in the forefront of your mind that whatever it is that you do, and 9 times out of 10, you're entering into a contract. So you always want to make the contract as ironclad as you possibly can be. And that is why I use the actual Supreme Court rulings and cases involving freedom of rights to travel when I'm doing the affidavits, when I'm going through the administrative process, when I'm serving these guys with this documentation and giving them every opportunity to rebut or refute the rulings of Supreme Court. See, they're not fighting against me. They're fighting against the truth that has already been ruled upon. So therefore, it puts them in a very precarious situation. And when we got a judge that want to try to ignore that, there's no need to argue with this guy. We just simply go ahead and let him know that we'll appeal. And, of course, eventually we won because we've got all the evidence. We went through the process. Everything is in order. We followed proper procedure, administrative procedure. And 9 times out of 10, if you do it right, you never have to even get into the court because the administrative process precedes any other process prior to going to court. Now, let's look at this thing from a different angle now. Redemption of your straw man. Let's go in there and look at and keep in mind our contract and contract law in regards to this situation, okay?
A corporation is a fictitious entity that has no hands, no eyes, no brain, and cannot affect any change on any flesh and blood man or woman. Only a flesh and blood man can charge you in court for an injury or breach of contract. A corporation cannot charge you, a flesh and blood man, but it can charge another corporate fictitious entity. So they had to create a corporation that would represent you and thus be able to be affected by them. The trick is that they ask the flesh and blood man to stand in as surety for the corporation, and not knowing that there is a difference between the two, we do so. I will stand in place of the fiction in court when my name is called, rather than point out that it isn't my name at all. It is a similar name, but it is in all capital letters, and that makes all the difference. I mean, when they call your name, they don't announce that it's in all capital letters, do they? Is John Doe here in the court today? And you stand up and say, "Here, Your Honor." So right there, you have said that you are the all-capital name, which is the charge on the charging instrument. If you get a traffic ticket, it's in the all-capital name. If you have a court case, it's in the all-capital name. So why stand up and offer to be the surety for that name? So to gain control of the straw man, one has to understand what the straw man is, what its purpose is, and the rules of law that allow you to get your needs met. Let's go over what the straw man is once more. The straw man, i.e. John H. Doe in all capital letters, is a vessel in maritime admiralty law, a corporate fiction, ens legis, which is defined as, quote, a creature of the law, an artificial being, quote, in Black's Law, 4th edition, ens legis. A fictional entity with no hands to sign a document, nor mouth to object to any mistreatment, and as such cannot act, cannot drive a car, cannot sign a bank card, nor a loan application. And yet the DMV driver's license, that bank loan, that car loan, that marriage license, that contractor's license are all labeled with the all capital lettered name as the responsible party of interest. Why? Could it be because the real flesh and blood man or woman is sovereign and doesn't need a driver's license if not engaged in commerce or permission to work on people's houses, which would be illegal without a license under the false legislative powers usurped by the falsely operating democracy? and in fact a common law right to work and work in whatever one desires, as stated in the Declaration of Independence, as the right to, quote, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And do we know what those are? Can we ask for them? If you don't ask for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you surely won't get it. But you have to state what that means to you in order to get it. What requirement could possibly exist to get a state-issued and controlled marriage license? Why make the state a third party able to control your relationship, which is only between you, your spouse, and God? Could it be that it gives the state the right to possess the fruit of your union or your children? This is the straw man's function, to falsely represent you, the flesh and blood, and give the corporate government the right to control you through your straw man. The United States, in all capital letters, is the parent corporation with all other forms of government subservient and divisions of the parent. In other words, the state of California as a corporation is subservient to the United States Corporation. The county of Sonoma is subservient to the state of California. The city of Santa Rosa is subservient to the state of California. These are all sub-corporations of the state of California, which is a sub-corporation of the United States. A corporation can have no effect lawfully on flesh and blood, as it is fictional. I mean, imagine a corporation. It's like a piece of paper in a lawyer's brief sitting on the desk. Can that corporation, can that piece of paper make you do anything? No, it's a piece of paper. That is why they need to invent another fictional entity to be equal with, that everyone is deceived into standing in as surety, the responsible party for the all caps name, is testament to the failure of the community to tell each member the truth of what is going on in this Alice in Wonderland fairy tale. So what can be done about it? What can that relationship be changed? We have to understand the rules of engagement in this world. The maxims of law are true 100% of the time and can't be questioned except by tyrants and dictators who would make their arbitrary law at their whim. The first and foremost is failure to object means you agree. If you don't refuse and disagree with things that you don't agree with, you lose the right to disagree. When in court, your sworn testimony, if it is not objected to or countered, stands as true and correct, and the final word. This is very powerful information. An example would be that your credit card company falsely states that you signed for a $3,000 vacation rental in Hawaii, and you didn't even go to Hawaii. If you don't complain about it and object to it, what do you think will happen? And you have to object in a timely fashion. You can't wait 2 years to object to it, because they'll come back and say, in the contract, you have a certain period of time to object, and that time period has elapsed. You will be charged the $3,000. You have to object. Even if you say, I don't think I did that, they will charge you. You don't have to tell a big story or even justify your reasons. Just state that it is false, and that is your sworn testimony. You would fill out an affidavit, have it notarized, and swear the statement is true. Then know that unless they get a sworn test affidavit by someone else stating that you signed for the vacation rental, they lose. The problem will come when they try and get someone to swear to it, because the hotel concierge will not want to put his name on a document swearing it was you, because he does not know you. And he knows, or has reason to believe, you are contesting it, and will then sue him, as you will have his wet ink signed affidavit as evidence. See the problem for the other side? This will be the case with government officials, bank presidents, police officers, etc. No one will think lightly of swearing something is true unless that is their true experience because of the commercial liability. Or, in other words, courtroom liability that comes with giving written evidence. Another maxim of law is truth is sovereign in commerce, if in a contract one party is lying or being deceitful, then they lose in court. If you declare something to be true, it had better be true, because you will become liable if it is not. If I declare my straw man is a fictitious entity, do I have to worry that he will object to that? No. If I declare that the straw man owes me everything he has acquired in his bank account, his deed of trust for real property, his title to cars, his furniture, etc., and he doesn't object, that makes it true. Will he object, or more importantly, how could he object? He's a fictitious entity with no mouth to speak. Was it not my labor and blood, sweat, and tears that purchased all those things? If I want everyone in the world to be able to know that I am the creditor and my straw man is the debtor and owes everything in his possession to me, how could I do that? I would put it on a UCC-1 financing statement, and that way everyone could witness the straw man, John H. Doe's indebtedness to me, John H. Doe, in upper and lowercase letters. What difference would that make? Well, once you do your publicly recorded UCC-1 and send it off to your Secretary of State demanding that they recognize you as the creditor and not the straw man, and give them 30 days to rebut your right to do that, you will not have to answer in court for the straw man ever again. Once you show that they defaulted on rebutting your claim of being the creditor and separate from the debtor straw man.
Okay. Now, do y'all see how important it is to deal with and understand contract law? Offer and acceptance, making sure that you clearly remain in control of a contract situation. Because once you allow someone else to take control of your contract situation, that puts you on a losing end. You have a man that comes to you and say, well, look, I want to, could I cut your yard for you? Well, how much you charge? I charge $25. Okay, well, for the $25, let's step outside here, and I want you to show me everything that I'm going to get for the $25 so I can see if that will be reasonable. And that's going to bring us to our next point. We're going to get to that in a minute. And he says, well, I'm going to cut the grass, and I got my hedge trimmer, so I trim up the hedges. And so it's at this point that you might ask him, you're going to rake it up too and put it in bags? You got bags and all that to put it in? He might say, well, man, that's going to cost you a little bit more. So, you know, you're negotiating, but you're not letting this guy come to you and say, can I cut your yard? You ask how much you charge, you say $25. And you go outside, and he cuts the yard, and after he gets through cutting the yard, he hasn't trimmed the hedges, he hasn't raked the yard, he hasn't picked up the hedge clippings that he cut off, or any of that, even if he did that, haven't edged up anything. And then you say, wow, man, you know, this ain't it. Well, man, you know, I told you I cut the yard for $25. You know, so you can avoid all that by making sure that you clearly understand and get a clear understanding of the terms of the contract. Because what just happened is a man came to you, and you and him began to discuss a verbal contract. And it may not seem that important to you, but you are dealing with a contract. You have to understand that. And so when we start looking at things from that position, and the reason why this is so important is because the United States operates on a continuous series of contracts, contract law. We got trust law, that's the highest law in the land. The highest office of trust law, which is the highest law in the land, is the Office of Executive of the Estate. And the gentleman just told you about the UCC-1 financing statement and taking control of the assets and stuff that you work hard and sweat and bled over all your life and making it a public record and putting them in a position where they can refute your claim as being the rightful owner of all the property that they for the fictitious entity that they created, which they'll find it very, very, very difficult to do that. If you write up the right contract and go ahead and send it, always send it certified mail with return receipt. But now, let's deal with something else. We're going to deal with whether or not a the reasonability of a contract. A contract or whether it had to be reasonable or not. Let's deal with that.
I'm Christian Molesky, Executive Officer of the HBA of Berks County, Pennsylvania. And I'm not an attorney. I am an MBA. We're going to translate the lofty ivory tower language of the attorney into thingamajig, how you doing, and whatchamacallit, so that the average Joe and Jane contractor can apply it to their business today. Although this is based on Pennsylvania law, it will apply in most other states as well. Written, verbal, or applied, we're on page 2 in the middle there. What applies here is something called the doctrine of reasonable expectation. When you talk to the lawyers, they use this word reasonable quite a bit, which is kind of funny coming from the attorneys, but we'll hold off on the attorney jokes for now. The reasonable man standard is applied across the legal field. It's used quite often. In other words, they say, what would a reasonable man think or do? Obviously, man used to mean both the male and the female genders. What would it, because this goes way back, obviously coming first from English law and being translated into what we would think of as American law. And so there's a lot of history that goes behind this. And even the English law, some of that comes from Roman law and some of the other early civilizations. So this goes back to reasonable man theory. Not what would the crazy court gesture think. Not what would the crazy cat lady down the street think, but what would the reasonable person? In other words, if I asked 100 people, at least probably 80 or 90 of them are the reasonable. You always have those crazy people that, you know, 11% or something like that say we haven't landed on the moon, and you know, these kind of things. So those are the people that we probably wouldn't think of as the reasonable ones. So this is who are the reasonable people. And the doctrine of reasonable expectation is applied to contracts. So, in other words, there has to be a does it make sense factor. It has to, you know, in common language, does it pass the smell test? Does this make any sense? If the two of you had a contract and I read it, either before you engage in the terms of the contract, whatever it is, selling widgets, buying services, renting an apartment, whatever the case may be, if I read it, does it make sense? Do I feel as though each party is getting consideration? You're giving this and getting that, and she or he is giving this and getting that. Do I feel as though there's an equal balance? Does it make sense? Do I feel as though, you know, for example, you couldn't have a contract for anything that's illegal. We couldn't have a contract that says, I will agree to give you $50 if you sell me a bag of marijuana. We couldn't have a contract that says, I will agree to give you $1,000 if you agree to be my slave for X number of hours or X number of days.
Okay. We're going to go on with the reasonability of a contract because I have some other things I want to lay on you in that regard so that we can clearly understand some things, because a lot of people get off the track when it comes to being reasonable involving your contract. So I need y'all to hold on for a second, and we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm back. First of all, before I go back to finishing up on the reasonability of contract, I want to say something about the information that is available to you in Tahaka's archives. All the templates that you will need to do your UCC-1 financing statement, to draw up the affidavits, just a continuous line of contracts. You don't have to refurbish anything. You simply fill in the blanks. It's right there in Microsoft Word for you, and you crank it out. You crank it off your printer and take it up there and put it on legal paper. Take it up there and get it notarized and signed and all did it up. And that way, when you got yourself with the proper tools, in the event that something goes on with yourself or one of your family members, you can go home immediately and you have a resource base in order to deal with the situation right there, point blank. We're going to say that a person, you have a home. And all of a sudden, you hear a big commotion going on back there in your backyard. And you come out there, and these people are digging this big giant hole. They got this equipment back there, all these tractors and these men and working and digging. And you are going around, what's going on? They say, well, we're installing a swimming pool. And you say, wow, okay, you installed a swimming pool. Well, okay, carry on. And you go on back in the house and you wait and let them go and do all their work and they install it. You don't know anything about it. You didn't order it. And after it gets done, you can put on your swimming trunks and go out there and get in the water. But then you stop and think for a minute. Wait a minute. I never authorized anybody to put a swimming pool back there. I'm going to sue this company. Well, you'll discover that when you get to the courthouse and you try to level of suit against these people, the judge gonna say, well, come out and put a swimming pool in your backyard, right? Yeah, they sure did, and I never told anybody that I wanted a swimming pool in my yard. I never ordered a swimming pool. They just come back down with it, dig it in and installed it. The judge can say, well, what did it look like? Well, it looks nice. Well, did you get in? Well, yeah, I got in and I went for a swim, and you just lost the case right there. Because you're being unreasonable. Now, if you had went out of town and you stayed a month and you came back and there was a swimming pool in your backyard that you didn't authorize, nobody in the family authorized it, but yes, there it is right there. Well, it's at that moment that you have a case. But if you go out there and get in that swimming pool and start swimming around and enjoying yourself all through the summer, and then when wintertime comes, you discover that you got to do maintenance and keep it up and all that, you want to try to sue. No. You're going to lose that case. So I just want to put that in there when it comes to reasonability. But as far as the archives are concerned, the way you access that is simply by contacting me, Tahaka, at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's 904-303-9061. And please do so before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It is an online archive. This thing is massive. There's tons of information. There's videos, the information. We even have information on whether or not there were giants in the earth. Everything that you need to know about religion, your health. Information is there from the best. Holistic medicine is there. Everything you need to know about law, contract law is there. Civil law, federal law, state law is there. If someone's garnishing your wages, how to deal with foreclosures, how to deal with your bill collectors, you name it. Going into the courtroom, operating outside of the courtroom, what to do when you're stopped by a police officer. It's just so much information. Everything that you have to understand about your culture and your story, everything that you need to know about Egypt, the pharaohs are there, American history is there, Egyptian history is there, Greek history is there, you name it, Is there Asian history, ancient history? Is there information on Atlantis? Is there you name it, is there. And it is a very, very important archive. And I think that every man in America that's calling himself a man need to have a library in his house, because that is power. Knowledge is power. And so you have that there. And a lot of us have kids that like to get on the computer and look around. Well, they have somewhere they're going, and it's very, very captivating, because the information that is in this archive, I have a lot of people that have children that are in this library on a daily basis. They're studying, they're running off articles, they're reading articles, they're looking at very, very important videos. So when they get up some size and they run into this thing, they'll have some kind of a foundation in their mind about how to handle things. And it behooves a mother and a father to provide such a powerful tool for their children, so that they can be able to dispense and separate and know the difference between fact and fiction, and a lot of the misconceptions that's being peddled inside the school system for truth. So it behooves you all to contact me in regards to Tarka's Archives, and I'll get you in there. And you simply just contact me by telephone, 904-303-9061, before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I'll get you in there. I need you all to hold on one more second, and we'll be back. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's not forget January the 12th and 13th, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. We'll have Summit of the Moors. We got Moorish Brothers coming into Jacksonville from all over the United States, as far as California, as far as Miami, New York City, you name it, Oregon, Chicago, Missouri, from everywhere. And this is going to be the place for one of the biggest workshop events in the history of the city, Jacksonville. And for those of you who can make it, we certainly it will be a benefit to you to be here. That's going to be January the 12th and the 13th. We're going to start at 11 in the morning, and we won't stop for a little short breaks, but this thing will continue to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and then we'll come in at 11 Sunday morning, and we won't stop until 7 p.m. Now, the hotel accommodations and stuff has already been set up and arranged for you guys, and you all can get your rates and all of that. If you go to www.dialosecu.com, that's dialosecu.com's website, and register, and this event is free. So make sure that you be there, and make sure you have your writing utensils with you, because there's going to be a great deal of information dropped at the summit. We're going to cover all the bases, and this is an economic summit where we can put together an economic base inside the United States for people of African descent, and that's what this thing is about. And it is an event that I think that everyone should attend. If you can be down here on that day, we certainly appreciate it, because this is going to be something to take advantage of and something to benefit from. So make sure that you come down here. Now, once again, I have been banned off of Facebook. So for those of you who would like to have access to my wall there, just send your friend request to Tahaka Amana El Bay, and I'll grant that friend request, and that will give you access to my wall. We're going to be placing a ton of more new information on there. Starting first thing in the morning, I'll be posting some stuff up there on some little money-making opportunity, and some more educational materials are going to be posted there. Also, this month we will be adding a ton of new information to Tahaka's archives too, so be on alert for the advertisement for the new information that has been added. So I think we've covered all of the bases this evening. We're going to come back with part two of this thing. And if you all have any questions, now's the time for you to raise your hand, and I'll go ahead and answer those questions for you. Okay? Now, keep in mind that we've been talking about contract law and the importance of contract law. And we're going to hold on. I got one hand that's raised. Area code 570. Could you tell us who you are? What's your question and comment? 570.
Yes, good evening, brother. Peace. My name is, my government name is Nolas Dennis. I'm in the Pennsylvania Republic.
Okay.
My question to you is, you spoke earlier about briefly about the UCC and I guess its application. Why is it that certain organizations are saying that that is a antidote or whatever for incarceration? I've heard brothers just say, you know, basically like using UCCs as a curse. Is it because these organizations are 503C obligated, or what's going on with the whole UCC scare?
Well, the UCC is it is basically a rule that was put down by the government on an opportunity for you to, as a remedy, for you to simply put the powers that be on notice of the fact that you are taking possession of all the assets. See, they are the ones that created this fictitious title. And a lot of time what happens is people attempt to do the UCC thing, and then they want to come back and try to do something else that's not consistent with what you're doing. See, now, if you think about it in common sense terms, this fiction was created for you. Everybody's requiring it of you. You go to the bank and you tell them, well, look, I don't have a driver's license, but I have an ID, and it's in upper lowercase letters. Well, the bank won't give you an excuse for not doing business with you, because if you know, we don't want to do business with the flesh and blood, man. We want to do business with the fiction, because all the assets is held in the title of the fiction. You see what I'm saying? But now when you take and you do the UCC-1 financing statement, and you put it on public record that all of the assets that's being held by this fiction, the Social Security card, all your bill collectors, everybody, they want to deal with fiction. They want to deal with man. But when you take and take control of all the assets and put the Secretary of State on notice of the fact that, this is the law right here. This is what I've done. Here's a copy of it, the public record. Here go all the assets. It's been signed. It's been stamped. It's noted that this affidavit is on notice. Here's an opportunity for you to refute and prove to me that what I just did is illegal. And of course, if they don't, and they won't, not especially if you do it right, then that's the end of that. So they can. You got a public record now that you can file into the court record if you ever have to go there, and they can never stick you to that anymore. And what about it? It doesn't have anything, and you know, a lot of people get things misconstrued. They try to take things and make it fit into their little system of things, and I see a lot of brothers tell me a lot of different things about that, but I just listen to them, and because it's not complicated, it's very, very simple.
Okay, brother.
You have another question?
No, that's it.
All right. Well, you stick around and
just want to say that I enjoy your show. I mean, I just recently became affiliated with your site, and brother, I honestly must say that it's like you're breaking atoms if you're using that metaphor. So let's keep up the good work, and may the ancestors continue to bless you.
Well, thank you, brother. That's what I'm here for. Try to leave something for us. Do something. Somebody got to help
us. That's right. All right, brother.
All right. Peace, man.
Peace.
Okay. If there's anybody got any more questions, now's the time to raise your hand, and we'll get your questions answered. Follow the props on your phone and raise your hand, and I'll answer your questions. We are discussing contract law. And if you got any questions about contract law or the administrative procedure process, how do you deal with the sheriff's department, how you deal with your bill collectors, how to respond when your mortgage company sends you in the mail, some stuff in the mail, and, you know, how to go about doing these things. And there are a lot of things that you can also do, what I call preventative measures. You want to set up things. Go ahead, and a lot of us don't have a will on file. We want to get that done. We want to want to get your will done. We have an excellent will, quite a few copies of wills inside my archives, and you can go ahead and do that. You can take advantage of the administrative portion of that will, where you get a chance to add your attachments, your affidavit of identity. You can do your Declaration of Human Rights of 1948 and attach it to your Notice of Understanding and Intent and Claim of Right, and you get these documents signed and notarized. Your estate letter, it should also be a part of that. You can make your a copy of your UCC-1 financing statement a part of that, and you want to file that into the court as a deed. And now, when you have a problem with a traffic cop, or you got to go to somebody suing you, whatever the case may be, you get a chance to and also your judicial notice and proclamation of status. You want to file the administrative portion of that will, or have it assigned to the case, and then take it a step further and have it assigned to that judge. Now, there's a little fee for that. But that means that when it's time for you to go to court, he already has his information in his hand. So when he calls your name and you stand up and say, "Well, look, I'm the primary shareholder for this trust, sir," and he got everything right there in his hand, the fight over, the dog ain't got no teeth, you know. And so there are a lot of things that you can do when you take a little time out to study. Those of you who are plan on getting my archives. If you just took an hour a day, just 1 hour a day, do wonders for you, and because you are putting worthwhile information into your brain. I have televisions in my house. I got to dust them off, cause I especially the screen, cause it's full of dust. I don't watch TV and I don't know how long, cause I don't have time for that. You know, I don't do that. There's nothing in there for me. There are over 60 million moles inside the United States, and I think that I should do something to aid them personally. That's just a personal thing that I want to do. I am a minister for the Moorish government, and I want to contribute to the uplifting of our fallen humanity, and this is why I do the things that I do. And ladies and gentlemen, the time is fleeting. And if you all have any questions, like I said, now is the time to raise your hand, and I'll go ahead and answer your questions. I want you all to stay tuned for Sunday's broadcast, because we're coming in with civil and federal court procedures with Brother Kamitu Ubay. He's going to be here with us, and we're also going to do part two of our contracts. We'll have a whole brand new segment of information to bring to the table. From a whole different angle, because it is so important for us to understand contract law. I see we have one, area code 347. Let me open up this line. Area code 347. Hello. I'm here.
Hey, what's going on, fam? What's going on? How you doing tonight?
I'm doing just fine, brother. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a quick question. As far as the administration process, how many notices do you have to send after you send the primary, like the affidavit of truth? How much notices will follow behind that until you actually finish the entire process?
Well, the administrative process goes this way. You basically, once you understand the process, you can pretty much feel your way through it. A lot of times you know, because see, when you, it starts in the beginning. If someone sends you something, we'll say in the mail, that you disagree with, because we did the thing with the verbal thing out there with the cop. But let's say someone sends you something in the mail that you disagree with. Okay, you can take that thing on the day that you get it, turn it diagonally and write no contract on it, and attach a letter to it explaining your position, because what they're attempting to do is get you to enter into a contract. Now, if you don't respond, that means you accept that contract.
Yeah.
You see? But now, if you go ahead and attach a letter to that thing, put it in an envelope, make copies of it now, and put it in an envelope, send it right back to them, and within a three-day span, you got to do this within 3 days, and then we'll see what happens next. Now, if they send it back and they insist on trying to do something different, and they're claiming that, well, you owe them some money. What else? Now we want to do an affidavit. Now, once you do that affidavit, you're going to give them 20 days to respond, 20 or 21 days, okay? Now, if they don't respond, then you come back after the 21-day period, at that last day, then you're going to send a notice of default with the opportunity to cure. What you're doing is you're simply going to your brother in an attempt to resolve the matter, and you are providing proof that you have done that. You see what I'm saying? Okay,
yeah.
So let's say he don't respond those 10 days. Then you come back with a notice of default with dishonor. So now you've sent three documents, that's 20, that's 25, 30, that's 40 days, and if he doesn't respond then, and he's still trying to take advantage of you, then you can go ahead and file a lawsuit. If he's taken something from you, if he's garnished your wages unlawfully, if he's repossessed something unlawfully, you go ahead and exhaust that process. So when you go get ready to go into the courtroom, you got a folder in your hand. You got that entire administrative process in your hand. You have it assigned to the case.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? That's called administrative procedure. But a lot of people, what they'll do as soon as something goes wrong, well, I'm going to get a lawyer. And they'll run and get a lawyer, and a lawyer go down there, and the lawyer start losing.
It's all part of the game.
Yeah, it's part of the game. So if we understand the game, and even if, and I tell people, even if you got a lawyer, make sure you understand something about law, so when the lawyer and the prosecutor and the judge get to talking legalese, at least you will know what's being said.
Yeah.
You won't have to, they done spoke for 2 hours, you sit there, and then after you heard about 2 hours worth of information, you turn around and ask the lawyer, well, what happened?
Oh.
So don't do that to yourself. Go ahead and study. So when they say certain things, you know, and you see the lawyer going the wrong way, you say, hold on, man, hold on, objection, y'all. He's fine. I'm gonna take it. I do a better job than he do. I know more about this than he do. So that's why it behooves us to study, and that's how that go. You got another question?
Nah, that was it. Thanks for answering.
Okay. All right, brother. Where you calling from?
From Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, okay. Brooklyn, New York. All right, brother. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, time is has run out on us, and I hope you all give me a call in regards to talk of our cast, and so we can get you all in there. And it's been certainly a pleasure discussing this with you. We are going to come back and do part two. And I've been your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay. And until next time, y'all take it easy.
Lord, it's happy.